24. Awesome, awesome chapter. And really, we're combining Matthew 24 and 25 because our goal here in this lesson really is not to do a verse-by-verse breakdown. That would take a long time. Not sure. I know since I've been here, I haven't really preached on preterism at all. But I know that's been certainly an issue in the area where I grew up in Indianapolis and in other areas, which is the idea that all of the prophecies concerning the comings of the Bible have been fulfilled in 70 AD. And I know that's been discussed in various places, and Matthew 24 and 25 are really the two of the key texts when it comes to that particular issue. And so it's important for us to try to understand it and rightly divide it so that we might understand the scriptures properly. My dad, who's going to be here next week for the gospel meeting, is actually preparing for a debate on preterism. He's already debated it one time about 10 years ago. And he'll be having a second debate, I believe, in the spring with an individual in Indianapolis, where the entire congregation is preterist now. And when I was in Kokomo, he actually sent messages to all of the members of the congregation in Kokomo, which he had done to congregations all throughout Indiana, challenging them to let him come and speak publicly, which we did not do. But actively trying to proselytize people to this doctrine. So it's important if you're going to understand you know, right and wrong on this, that you understand Matthew 24 and 25. So we're going to think about that a little bit here today. Just think about the big picture, what's being talked about. So I'm going to introduce it with just this quote. We're not going to quote from a lot of people today on the screen because we're just going to try to read through the text and try to understand it. But Matthew 24 is often referred to as the Olivet, or it's also referred to as the eschatological discourse, because it was delivered on the Mount of Olives and because it deals with the last days, which that's what eschatology is. Eschatology is a study of the last days and those doctrines surrounding it, of biblical Israel, as well as the final judgment. What makes Matthew 24 difficult reading for so many is the use of apocalyptic language, which we could say that about the book of Revelation. We could say that about Zechariah. We could say that about certain sections of the prophet Daniel. But apocalyptic language is sometimes, because we don't speak that way and we don't, you know, use language in that way perhaps, sometimes it's difficult for us to understand. But it's a highly symbolic genre of sacred literature that is used to depict God's judgment on the wicked or his deliverance of the righteous. And I believe that some of what Jesus is saying in Matthew chapter 24, he is using apocalyptic language. So let's start with what I think are the three most important verses to set up this section, and that's Matthew 24, verses 1 through 3. I think we've got to understand the questions that are being asked here in these first three verses and the context in which they are being asked for us to understand a little bit more about the context ahead. So, because there's a lot of different ways that people look at Matthew 24. There are people who look at all of Matthew 24 and all of Matthew 25 as all being fulfilled in 70 AD. That would be preterism. There are people who look at Matthew 24 being split up. Some people stop it at verse 35. Some people split it up at verse 41. But some of it being fulfilled in 70 AD and some of it looking ahead to the final coming of Jesus when he returns. There are others who look at Matthew 24 as a double fulfillment, some of it being fulfilled in 70 AD, but some of it are signs that are we're waiting for the end of the world. And so that's, you'll hear people sometimes when there's a war going on or a threat of war, they'll start quoting from Matthew 24 and say, well, these are signs that the end of the world is coming. So there's like three very, very different views of Matthew 24. And I think these questions right here help us understand what the view should be that's biblical. So let's take a look at it. As some spoke of the temple, very important. So temple where? In Jerusalem. That's where they are, right? They're in Jerusalem here. And as some spoke of the temple, Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. It's kind of a massive complex. And his disciples point out the buildings of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations. And then one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what manner of buildings are here." It was just an impressive display of architecture to come to Jerusalem and to see the temple grounds. And Jesus said to them, especially at this time, by the way, because Herod spent years rebuilding this temple and making it a very, very beautiful site. So assuredly, Jesus says, "Do you not see all these great buildings and things?" The buildings of the temple in Jerusalem. "Assuredly, I say to you, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now, as he sat at the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, the disciples, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, came to him privately. So they asked him, saying, "Teacher, tell us, when will these things be?" So there's one question. When will what things be? When is the temple going to get torn down? When are the buildings of the temple going to get torn down? When will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place and be fulfilled? Now, depending on if you're reading the Matthew text or the Mark text or the Luke text, we're combining all three of these texts. But combine all those questions together. Those are the questions that are asked, okay? So they want to know, when is the temple going to be destroyed, and are there going to be some signs preceding it? All right? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So I want you to see, we don't have just one question here. We really have about three questions here. And we need to understand the questions being asked so that we can understand the context which follows it. And so that's why this first question is kind of important as we set up the lesson here today. All right? So question one is this. And let's back up into Matthew 23, just a couple of verses, because we also need to remember what Jesus has said just prior to this. So many times chapters are, you know, your worst enemy to understanding the Bible, because they'll just break up a context right in the middle of it. And Matthew 24:1 is connected to Matthew 23, verse 38. So Matthew 23, verse 38 says, "See, your house is left to you desolate." He's speaking to Jews. What's the house of the Jews? Temple, right? Your house. He's not talking about the house they're living in. He's talking about the temple. That's your house. That's the house of God that David wanted to build, that Solomon built, that eventually was torn down, then it was rebuilt, and then Herod rebuilt it again. All right? So your house, the temple, is left to you desolate. What does it mean when you make something desolate? Empty. Yeah, empty. If you go to a desolate place, it's empty. You look around and it's a ghost town. It's like there's nobody living here. It's desolate. And so your temple, your house, is going to be left to you desolate. It's going to be made empty. And so the disciples know he's just said something about their temple, and that's what he's referring to, and that's why they're pointing out the temple when we get to Matthew 24 and verse 1. And so what does Jesus say is going to happen to the buildings of the temple? Not only is it going to be left empty, but what's going to happen to the actual structure? Yeah, it's going to be torn down. Not one stone left upon another. It's going to be torn down is the idea. So it's not like God's just going to vacate the building, which is what God's going to do. God has had enough of the Jews, and God is ready. He's given them, if you read Matthew 21, 22, 23, he sent them prophet after prophet after prophet. They've rejected those prophets. Now they're going to reject the Son. And he says, all right, God's going to leave the building. God's tried with you enough. God's done with you. God's going to leave. And your temple is going to be left to you desolate, but not only that, but your temple is going to get torn down. The structure is going to get torn down. So then we get to these questions in Matthew 24 in verse 3. And really there's two key questions that they're asking. What's the first question? Especially, when is this going to happen? When will these things be? What things? Well, not the end of the world. When will the temple be destroyed? When will not one stone be left upon another? That's what the first question is referring to, what he's just said. All right? And then there's a second question, though.
What will be the sign?
Yeah, will be the sign of your coming or of the end of the age, some versions would say. Okay? The end of the age. And so we seem to have really two different questions, and we need to consider that when we read Matthew chapter 24. I believe the answer to the first main question is found in Matthew 24 verses 1 through 35. I think everything you read in verses 1 through 35 is a reference to, an answer to, that first question. When is the temple going to be destroyed? What are going to be the signs preceding the destruction of the temple, which we know took place historically in 70 AD? And so I believe what you read in verses 1 through 35 is a reference to that. I believe that what you read after verse 35, that second main question, I believe the answer to the second question, what are going to be the signs of the end of the age, the final coming of Jesus, is answered beginning in verse 36, all the way really through chapter 25. So, not everybody agrees with me on that. That's maybe okay. But that's where I'm at. And if we had a lot of time, I would split this into like two or three lessons. But I just want to show you, first of all, verses 1 through 35. Let's just kind of start with that and see what we can get through here. So this is verses 4 through 14. Jesus answering him began to say, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he, the Christ,' and the time has drawn near, and will deceive many. Therefore, do not go after them. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars and commotions, but see that you do not be terrified or troubled. For such things must happen and come to pass first. But the end is not yet, and will not come immediately. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes in various places. There will be famines, pestilences, troubles, fearful sights, great signs from heaven. All these are the beginnings of sorrows. But watch out for yourselves, for before all these things, they will lay their hands on you, deliver you up to tribulation and councils." Who's the you there, by the way? Who's the you that's going to be delivered up to tribulation and councils and the people he's talking to, right? Which would be the disciples, the apostles. And so these are things that are going to happen. I think it's very, very important to notice while they're still alive, while the disciples are still alive. In fact, I'm just going to jump ahead to a verse that is one of the key reasons why I think there's a contrast. And that's verse 34, where Jesus says in verse 34, "I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." That's a time statement that tells you how to interpret the passage. It tells you that everything he said up to verse 34 is going to take place during the lifetime of those he's speaking to. All right? So that's why I believe there's a turn when you go through verse 35. "Heaven and earth will pass away. My words will by no means pass away." But there, verse 36, the "but" is where Jesus turns and starts answering, in my opinion, the second question. "Of that day and hour, no one knows." There's a huge difference in what he has just said. He's just given you signs. He's just given you things that are going to precede the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD when the temple is going to be destroyed, that God has left desolate and empty. And then he says, "But of that day and hour, no one knows." What's that day and hour? The final coming of Jesus. When Jesus returns finally, there's not going to be signs preceding it. It's going to be different. I'm not going to give you any time indicators for that. All right, but there are a lot of indicators leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem that he speaks to his disciples about. And so some of them are here, what we're reading right now. So Jesus answering them began to say, here's the rest of the context, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he, the Christ,' and the time is drawn near and will deceive many. Therefore, do not go after them. You will hear of..." Did I already read that? I probably did. Yeah, sorry. We'll just keep reading it. That's why when I interrupt myself, I get lost. So, interrupting my own train of thought. "Do not go after them. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars and commotions, but see that you do not be terrified or troubled. Such things must happen, come to pass first, but the end is not yet and will not come immediately. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes in various places. There will be famines, pestilences, troubles, fearful sights, great signs. All these are the beginnings of sorrows. But watch out for yourselves, for before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and deliver you up to tribulation councils. You will be beaten in the synagogues," that's a Jewish place of worship, "and prisons. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my name's sake. but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony to them. Now, before we get to the second part of this, has anybody ever heard this verse applied to things that are happening right now, today? Yeah, you ever been talking to somebody and they're like, well, the Bible says there's going to be wars and rumors of wars, and that's what we see. You know, Iran's building up their nuclear weapons in Korea, and they'll start quoting from different countries that we're in conflict with at the time. They've been doing this since World War I, World War II, every war that we have. People start quoting and saying, well, this is a sign, the end of the world is coming. And I think we're misusing the context. So we'll try to prove that here in a minute. When they arrest you, the disciples, by the way, did most of the apostles get arrested for their faith and persecuted? Yes, they did. And so Jesus is telling them, when they arrest you and deliver you up, do not worry beforehand or premeditate what you will speak and answer. Why? Because Jesus had promised in John 16, you're going to be guided into all truth. The Holy Spirit's going to be with you. So you don't have to think about it. The Holy Spirit will guide you into what you're going to say and answer. Whatever is given you in that hour, speak that. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. And then many will be offended and betray one another. You will hate one another. And then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Brother will betray brother to death. A father his child. Children will rise up against parents and relatives and friends and will cause some of them to be put to death. You will be hated by all nations for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. By your patience possess your souls. He who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom must first be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. All right. So, there's a lot of Bible teachers that try to apply the earlier sections of Matthew 24 to modern day events, but I want to take a look at some of the following predictions along with some other Bible passages and note how these predictions were fulfilled in the first century. So we've got Matthew 24, 4 through 6, which I'm just looking at the Matthew passage because it's just easier than flipping back and forth through the three different Gospels. But and that's the passage where people are going to deceive, they're going to say, they're going to claim to be the Christ. There's going to be wars and rumors of wars. So a couple passages I want you to note. First of all, the scriptures mention in Acts 5, 36 and 37, it mentions Thutis and Judas. And it also mentions Simon the sorcerer. What were these people claiming to be? Thutis and Judas and Simon the sorcerer. We'll take a look at it. Acts 5, 36 and 37. This is something that Gamaliel notes. He says, some time ago, Thutis rose up claiming to be somebody. And then it says in verse 37, there was another man, Judas of Galilee, who rose up in the days of the census and drew many people after him. Gamaliel is comparing these men to Jesus and saying all these people who are preaching Jesus, well, there's been other people who have claimed to be somebody, claimed to be the Christ or the next great prophet or whatever. And he said it's come to nothing. So maybe we shouldn't worry so much about this Jesus that people are preaching. What I want you to see by that reference is that Jesus predicted that within the lifetime of his people, there would be people claiming to be the Christ. And we actually see that in biblical history with Thutis and Judas. We see it with Simon the sorcerer, who people perceived as someone who was great. So these things were happening. We don't have to look at right now. We don't have to look at 2020 to look for this. This was happening in the first century, what Jesus predicted. These signs also include wars and rumors of wars, and I just want to notice a few things with you, that during this time, up to AD 70, there were four emperors in Rome who died within 18 months. Those weren't all natural causes. There was a lot of infighting. Jesus predicted that that sort of thing was going to be happening, so it was happening in the first century. There were 50,000 Jews who died in Seleucia in the first century. There were 20,000 Jews who died in Caesarea in the first century. And there were constant rumors of wars that the Jews were hearing from the Romans. And so a study of first century history would tell you that these wars and rumors of wars were happening. And they were hearing about these things in the first century. We don't have to look to 2020 and look at what's going on with all the current events to see something like this happening. Jesus said it was going to happen in the lifetime of these people present, and it was happening. There were also famines and pestilences and earthquakes. One of the things we read in Acts 11 and verse 28 was that some of the brethren sent money from Antioch down to Judea, but why? Why did they want to send some money and some help and some goods, whatever it was they sent? Why did they want to send that? There was a famine. Yeah. And Jesus had predicted that before AD 70, there's going to be famines and pestilences. And that's exactly why they had to send aid from one church to another, because that's what was happening. And so we see that account biblically. There was a severe pestilence that often followed famine. Often following famine, there's pestilence, and there's one such pestilence that occurred in Babylon in 40 AD. There were also, what's he say about earthquakes? Sometimes people will look at earthquakes that are going on today or volcanoes and say, well, that's a sign, the end is coming. Well, there were many earthquakes that occurred between the statement that Jesus made here in 70 AD. There was an earthquake in Crete in AD 46. There was an earthquake in Rome in 51 AD. There was an earthquake in Apamea in Phrygia in 53 AD. There was an earthquake in Laodicea in 60 AD. And they actually funded the rebuilding of their own city with their own money. In Laodicea, which is why in the seven churches to Asia that are written to in Revelation, you guys say you're rich, is one of the statements that's made. That was one sign of their wealth. They didn't even need Rome's assistance. They could rebuild their own nice city after it was torn down by an earthquake. Campania, there was an earthquake in 62, and one that we've heard of, right, is Pompeii. There were tons of earthquakes that were occurring all throughout this area up to AD 70. So we don't have to look at earthquakes and that are happening in 2020 and think that that's a sign of the end of the world. It's a sign that Jesus said would precede the destruction of Jerusalem. Let's look also in Scripture, and he says there's going to be persecution, right? You're going to be delivered up, you're going to go on trial, you're going to be persecuted, you're going to stand before synagogues and rulers and kings. Do we see that happening in biblical history? Stephen, Acts 7 and verse 59, he's stoned after he gives a great speech before many leading Jews. Church in Jerusalem is being persecuted in Acts chapter 8. And so they scatter and begin preaching other places. James, who was the one who made the decision to have James beheaded? It's one of the Herods in Acts 12. And so James becomes the first apostle that's martyred. And then Paul. I mean, you can't read the story of Paul throughout the book of Acts without seeing that he was being chased out of synagogue after synagogue, city after city, and he stood, just as it was promised him, he stood before kings and rulers. And so Jesus was predicting not necessarily things that are going to happen in 2020 again, predicting things that were happening to his own disciples prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. There would be false teachers. In Acts 15, there was this big council, this big debate that takes place. What was that about in Acts 15? In the first century. What was the problem? Right, right. There were certain Jews who were telling Gentile converts, you have to be circumcised or you're not truly a Christian, right? You weren't following the Jewish customs. And so there were false teachers in Acts 15. Jesus says there's going to be false teachers preceding the destruction of Jerusalem. We see it documented in the book of Acts. Daniel, you had a hand up there.
Puts it in that time period.
Good. We could also mention, and we'll make sure we get to that verse 15 that you're segueing us into, so I appreciate that. Betrayal. You know, we could talk about betrayal. If you look at 2 Timothy 1 and verse 15, does Paul feel like he kind of got betrayed in the first century? Well, who does he think has sort of betrayed him or kind of left him behind? 2 Timothy 1 and verse 15. All those in Asia have turned away from me, among whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes. And then you look at chapter 4, verse 10, and Paul's on trial in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10. And he says, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. And then verse 16, at my first defense, no one stood with me. All forsook me. Well, Jesus predicted that in the first century, there's going to be people betraying one another, and their love is going to grow cold, and they're going... And that's exactly what happens. Tacitus is a historian, and he records this. He says, several Christians were at first apprehended, and then by their discovery, a multitude of others were convicted and cruelly put to death with derision and insult. That was happening in the first century because Christians began to be arrested. They began to be viewed as an enemy of the state because of their beliefs, because they would not worship Caesar. And then when certain Christians get arrested, they think, maybe I'll get out of it if I'll rat out my fellow Christian brothers and sisters. And so they did, and they started betraying each other. They started working against each other. And that's what Jesus said was going to happen. All right, so let's look at this Matthew 24. Like I said, there's no way we're going to get through all of this, but I wanted you to just start seeing a little bit of the evidence that makes it very clear that these things were happening in 70 AD. Dave? Colossians is written in the 60s A.D., so prior to 70 A.D. So what Jesus predicted would happen did happen, so good point. Well, let's take a look at this this other thing that gets mentioned here that really helps us to see. We're talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24, the first half. It says, so therefore, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place where it ought not, is near. Whoever reads, let him understand. And then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her. Let him who's on the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter to take anything out of his house. Let him who's in the field not go back to get his clothes. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Question. If we're talking about the end of the world, which if you read 1 Thessalonians 4, says it's going to happen in a twinkling of an eye, the coming of Jesus, like that, right? At the sound of a trumpet, he's going to return. If we're talking about that, are you going to have time to go get your stuff to get gathered together and take off and get out of the city? No, we aren't talking right here. This judgment is not a judgment of the entire world. This is a judgment that is upon Jerusalem, a specific city. And so he says, when you start seeing armies coming, get out of the city. And here's the reason why. Historically, the armies, Jerusalem shut up the walls of the city. The armies besieged the city and starved everybody in the city to death. If you read what Josephus writes about the wars of the Jews, he writes in great, great detail about the things that the events that occurred. And so Jesus says, if you don't want to be a part of that, when the destruction, the things preceding the destruction of Jerusalem, then you need to get out of the city. Don't even stop to get your clothes. Take off. Jesus, this is what's going to happen. And that's what happened. The Roman armies came, surrounded the city, and eventually destroyed the city. Exactly. So we see an obvious distinction. There's an obvious distinction between some of the things preceding this coming of Jesus, if you will, or the coming of this coming of the armies, the judgment of Jerusalem versus the final coming, and I think we have to point that out. Just a few things, because I know we've only got like a minute left, but it would have been, what is the abomination of desolation? I just want to mention to you, it would have been an abomination to see the idolatrous Roman armies filling the holy city of Jerusalem. It would have been an abomination to the Jew, and that's exactly what they did. Led by Titus in the 70 AD, they came and they entered into Jerusalem. That would have been an abomination to the Jews. These are Gentile people entering God's holy city and entering upon the temple grounds.
I thought I had read somewhere too that one of the Roman rulers had actually started sacrificing pigs in the temple during this time.
Right.
And so again, it's one of those things, you have an unclean animal actually in the temple being sacrificed, and he kind of knew the Jewish customs, and he was doing this to kind of thumb his nose at the Jewish people and stuff.
Yeah. Right, right. I think some of that happened during the Maccabean revolts, like during kind of the years of silence, which is what got the Maccabees riled up prior to Jesus. But it certainly, yeah, that certainly did happen, and it's what made the zealots the zealot party they were. They got tired of people disrespecting, and so they were willing to kill people that were going to do things like that in the temple. But good point. Josephus does mention, according to McGarvey, that there was 1,100,000 people who perished during the siege, and 97,000 people were taken captive. And of these latter, the 97,000 that were taken captive, many of them were tortured and slain, and many of them were crucified. This was a terrible, terrible time for the Jews, and that's why Jesus tells his disciples as a prophet, when you see the armies coming, leave. Don't even risk going back to get your clothes or food or anything. Just go. Because Jesus knew what was going to happen. All right. So much more we could cover. And I'm going to try to make some time to cover all of this, the rest of the context. But unfortunately, there's just way too much for us to try to get through with this text. So thank you for your attention today.